So let's start with where you wanted to start. You wanted
there were bits and pieces that I left out, and some of them, you know, may or may not be relevant to what it is you're trying to accomplish. And if I go off track, then you just tell me.
Okay.
One of the things I kind of left out, because your interest is really in the behavioral pharmacology as a discipline and how it emerged and changed.
Is that correct?
In abuse liability.
Yeah, I think the best description of what I'm doing is writing an intellectual history of the field.
In the field
and
being?
Behavioral addiction research, drug abuse research.
Okay.
But behavioral pharmacology becomes a very important piece of that at a certain point in time. And so
are you going to get into neuro and molecular pharmacology and receptor? And are you going to go talk to Saul Snyder?
Yes.
Opiate receptor and that sort of thing?
Yes. Okay. Whether I do that for this current book, I don't know. But I certainly have to mark that as the next
okay.
step.
So let's see. So I just wanted to flesh out the piece of behavioral pharmacology, at least from this personal perspective, as a graduate student in Minnesota. So my mentor was Travis Thompson, who was formidable in the field, and then his primary student, who was a force in his own right, was Roy Pickens. And then there was the Harvard access with Peter Dews and Roger Kelleher and Bill Morse, and then their students at the time, Don McMillan and Larry Bird, stand out. And then, of course, there's Bob Schuster at Chicago, and one of his students, Bob Balster, and then Jim Woods at Michigan, and Jim, of course, was a student of Schuster, and both Schuster and Thompson were students of Brady. So I just wanted to say that for the record.
These were all people
that kind of populated the domain of behavioral pharmacology and kind of informed our sense of what's the word I want to use? Our sense of standards. I mean, they were role models for us. So at one point, you asked, you know, so what has become of behavioral pharmacology as a discipline? And so I wanted just to back up and say a little bit more about that. So there are three aspects of this discipline that I can define. One is the use of behavior as a tool to study drugs, to inform us about how drugs work, and using behavior as a dependent variable to tell us something about pharmacology. And in that respect, behavioral pharmacology remains very much alive. It's part of pharmaceutical industry development. If you go into departments of pharmacology, there are people who would say, yeah, my primary dependent variables are behavior, and I use them to study drugs. And, you know, I'm not a neuropharmacologist. I'm interested in behavior. So I don't think that's been shaken. The use of drugs as a tool to study behavior, I think that's pretty, maybe that's the flip side. I can't quite put it together. The flip side of, you know, the addiction process. I mean, in this case, the behavior of interest is the addiction behavior. It's a drug behavior interaction, but there's some sense I have that aspect, the self-administration, or using drugs to study, to probe self-administration. So if you take the case, say, of cocaine self-administration as a baseline, then you'd use drugs to study that, and that's part of this whole enterprise of understanding addictive processes. But that's where drugs are just such a limited variable, and so that's where you go into all of neuroscience. So, you know, there's much more to do than manipulate only drugs. And so to that sense, in that sense, I have the idea that behavioral pharmacology has just been lost its boundaries, and it's just been incorporated hook, line, and sinker in many cases by enterprises that may not even recognize, you know, where the roots are, and they certainly might not identify it as behavioral pharmacology. An example might be people using drug discrimination methodologies to that's a little off, but anyway. And then there's another sense of, and this is almost the methodological approach of behavioral pharmacology. So one of the things that we were steeped in our training at University of Minnesota is the experimental approach as laid out by B.F. Skinner and one of his, I believe he was a student, Murray Sidman, who wrote a classic book called Tactics in Scientific Research. And Tactics of Scientific Research played off of B.F. Skinner's sense that the most interesting way to study behavior is at the level of the single organism and establishing a stable baseline of behavior, finding a way of measuring that behavior, and then systematically probing in to see how that behavior changes and determining the functional variables that alter that behavior. And so that's really the core of the behavioral pharmacology methods. That remains in many senses we're looking for stable behavior and changing things. What's changed methodologically is that, by and large, the scientific enterprise, for reasons that, and it may be a mistake, and we may swing back in a pendulum fashion in some years, but by and large, scientific enterprise no longer accepts within subject designs. So back in the 60s, you could publish a study with three rats or three pigeons or three monkeys that had been systematically studied, and each animal was their own control, and each animal told a story. And if you could replicate that story across three animals, you know, you could say something substantial and significant. I still believe that to be the case. However, what's happened is that the methodological zeitgeist now often requires groups of animals. So submitting papers to journals or grants for review, there's an expectation that you're going to present group data and some kind of analysis of variance. And that actually, in some sad way, constrains the types of questions you ask and the types of inferences you make. And so there's some sadness I have about that. But just to come back to that behavioral pharmacology, that piece actually has been, exterminated, at least temporarily.
Can I ask a question about the group? Is it that today groups are required, or large N?
It's a larger N, But you can run analysis of variance sometimes on four or five subjects, so it doesn't have to be big ends. And the lament for me is you actually you lose some of the precision of what you're going after when you start looking at group data, because it's the anomalous finding that is often the most interesting, and that's certainly what Skinner and Sidman and what we were taught to look for. And I think when you go back into the history of science, you'll probably find that's true in any discipline. And it's so really, it's intensely looking at the data coming out on a subject-by-subject basis, seeing something anomalous, and then saying, gee, I wonder why that happened. You know, maybe we should try to do this. But when you're in a group design, you're locked into certain parameters, you need to run an analysis of variance, you're much less likely to pursue the anomalous finding. And so that's strategy of research that somehow has been lost.
And can you offer any explanation for why that would be so?
I need to think about it more carefully, but I think in part, people who are trained in conventional statistical procedures and are trained looking at group data often just don't get the power of the individual subject data, so they don't fully imbibe the level of control and the precision of what's learned from a individual subject analysis. So in some ways it's just a bias. They're accustomed to looking for statistical power. They know they need 14 subjects, and you're presenting an N of 3. And so the reflex is, mm-hmm. 3 subjects, don't even tell me about it. I mean, you know, you need 14. And they're missing the orderliness of the data, the replicability of the data. More thoughtful, people that come from other kinds of scientific disciplines might not, if they think about it, be as reactive to that. So if you're looking at a pharmacological assay and you're looking at a guinea pig ileum assay, which is some, you know, muscle preparation, and you're, you know, flushing it with drugs and you see this contraction and then you give another drug and you block that contraction, and you do that very orderly, the question then becomes, how many different guinea pig iliums do you need in order to convince someone? And when you deal with a tissue preparation like that, people aren't going to say you need 14. You know, they say, you do it twice. You know, you do it once, and then you do it twice to make sure that it's replicable. And you do it 3 times, and then what you're getting into is questions of generality. And then there is a legitimate reason to increase the N, and that is that you want to know what the generalizability of this is. And there's certainly some kinds of scientific inferences that can only come forth with larger ends and looking for individual differences, but there's an awful lot of power in focusing in on the individual subject. Is that?
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Let's see, now they're just bits and pieces. What I ended up doing actually is making a list of and this just is personal, of some of the postdocs that I trained who became prominent in the field, and this is almost just illustrative of what the Hopkins Enterprise was up to. But then the other thing to note is that we now have trained second generation people. So we trained Warren Bickel and Steve Higgins, who set up a training program, and all these people come out of there. And these are just the notes, scribbling notes on the those other points that I made.
Could I ask you a question of clarification about Skinner in relation to Pavlov? Yesterday I interviewed Charles O'Brien, and he talked about what he was doing as Pavlovian conditioning. And when I asked him if he could clarify the differences, he just wanted not to talk about Skinner. He passed over it in a way that indicated that was an interesting question. There used to be a controversy in the field, he said. There used to be a great deal of interchange, but not anymore. Can you help?
What do you mean interchange?
Between Pavlovians and Skinnerians.
Yeah.
Can you characterize that for me in relation to what you've just said? What happened to Pavlovian? As I understand it, that's what Abe Wickler was doing. That's the form of conditioning that he was interested in at Lexington, and that was very different from what behavioral pharmacology, when it began to kind of coalesce, was doing.
Let's see. So Skinner laid out the principles of operant conditioning, and so operant conditioning is about behavior being maintained by its consequences. So a behavior that's followed by a reinforcing stimulus, the probability of that behavior increases in frequency. And it has a lot to do with most forms of emitted behaviors. Skinner was, well acquainted with respondent conditioning, which is Pavlovian conditioning, and that's integral in understanding behavior. And Skinner didn't downplay the importance of respondent conditioning, but thought that operant behavior, I don't know if he thought it was more important, but he chose to focus on that, and it really hadn't been appreciated as such a systematic studyable variable previously. So Pavlov had, Pavlov's dogs and the food powder and the salivation, that all has to do with conditioning or respondent conditioning. Very quickly, as behavioral pharmacology and developed, those principles all, interwove.
Okay.
And so there is no controversy. There are, there are certain effects that are respondently conditioned, and those can feed back on operant behavior. And so Chuck O'Brien, who I don't think would have ever identified himself as a behavioral pharmacologist, was interested in these classical conditioning features, and he thought that and did a systematic body of work looking at how these might provoke relapse, because you get conditioned effects that then serve as, then you put it in the operant language, and I think he would do this, these now serve as discriminative stimulus, changing the probability with which an operant response is going to be emitted and then reinforced. And so they all, it all comes together mm-hmm. very nicely.
Yes, it's just that you had a language that was somewhat different.
Well, it's really the focus of the language. So the experimental analysis of behavior and behavioral pharmacology, you know, you're taught operant and respondent conditioning. You need to know those mm-hmm. to understand behavior. But there was much more emphasis on the operant than the respondent.
So it's an emphasis.
Yes.
All right. And is it true that what Wickler was doing?
I think he was primarily interested, I believe that's the case, primarily interested in respondent.
And that was, in a sense, because he did not really have that language yet.
Yeah, and
it didn't reach him somehow.
Yeah, just the sense of orderliness of operant behavior of an animal responding. I mean, what Skinner did by putting a lever in a box and making food contingent on it, you know, all of a sudden a rat just kind of running around and sniffing and eating sometimes, you know, became a very orderly assay, you know, and you could describe that behavior really precisely. And as you set up conditions to control the environment, the apparent spontaneity and variability of behavior disappeared, and all of a sudden you had a very clean assay, if you will, to, you know, to look at an animal responding. And then part of Skinner's brilliance was seeing that it wasn't just lever pressing, it actually applied to, you know, all forms of behavior.
Thank you, that's very helpful.
And then, let's see, just a part of this is simply personal, but there's a piece I left out. Part of my graduate training with Thompson and George Bigelow's was that we ended up as doing behavior modification with the mentally retarded in one of the hospitals in Minnesota.
The state hospital.
Yeah, mm-hmm. at Faribault, Minnesota. And, you know, and it was that, and that was part of the experimental analysis of behavior and understanding that, that, you know, here you had these grossly deteriorated institutions with profoundly and severely retarded people just being housed under, you know, what would have to be described as inhumane conditions. And there was no sense that you could do anything for them. So they were cleaned up, you know, and then they sat in these bare day rooms and rocked back and forth, or were put in restraining rooms. And this whole technology of behavioral control, this is the power of the experimental analysis of behavior, says, hey, wait a second, you know, these people don't have to sit there, you know, let's teach them something. We have a technology for teaching something. It's a question of contingencies, and take a look at what contingencies you have existing in this situation, and no wonder they run around hitting each other. You have it understaffed, and the only time that anyone gets any attention is if they, you know, if they soil themselves or if they get aggressive, and then the staff come over and, you know, start interacting with them. And, you know, from a behavioral paradigm, it was just backwards. But anyway, this, you know, this was part of the part of the excitement of the experimental analysis of behavior. And so it was that, and I'm sure it would be true of George, and both George and I working in the hospital for the mentally retarded, so when it came to working with an alcoholic, you know, and trying to figure out alcoholism, the principles were really clear. We wanted to first establish a stable baseline of performance. This comes out of rats pushing levers. We wanted to see the behavior. We wanted to stabilize it. And then we wanted to go in and see, you know, what variables perturb that. How do you suppress that behavior? How do you get someone to, you know, to quit drinking? And so it followed very naturally, and it followed then very naturally that we felt that we could generalize our training from animals to humans. And so it was with no hesitation that, you know, George went off, you know, to Baltimore City Hospital, and I followed him shortly. And we thought, okay, you know, we're going to do behavioral pharmacology, but in this case it would be addiction pharmacology with humans. And we were just generalizing our knowledge from animal behavioral pharmacology and from behavior modification.
Mm-hmm. That's also very helpful.
Did George mention Faribault or not?
Yes, he did.
He did.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I actually asked him, I think, about it, because on his CV, he does it. It was on there as the first entry, and I realized, I wondered whether your study on chronic alcohol, the single subject study, came out of that experience or not. And so I asked him about it, I think.
Yeah.
I don't think he naturally said it.
Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, and he and I worked together under the mentorship of Travis Thompson and developed behavior modification programs for Award. We actually ended up publishing something on that together. That may be our first publication together. Let's see. Just another piece. I looked over my CV, and it was kind of misleading, with respect to the World Health Organization. And I don't know if that's of any relevance, but it turns out that I was at the World Health Organization not only in the early 80s, but then I've been on their expert committee from, I don't know, 85 on, and participated in these expert committees.
Yeah, it is actually a little misleading. So.
Yeah, well, part of when I said I'd come back and talk to you, then I actually read through my vita and found that. And then the other thing I did actually is go through my vita, and this may or may not be of interest, you know, but of course it's, personally it seems really compelling. so just cut me off if you don't want to hear this stuff. But what I did is circled some of the kind of the seminal.
Oh, that's excellent. Now that's very helpful.
Seminal points, and just wrote little notes to it. And one of the interesting and sad things, because, you know, I've split my time between animal and human behavioral pharmacology, but I've ended up circling virtually all human stuff and no animal stuff. But let me just tell you.
And that's because.
Because I think that's. I think other people. I was participating in a community. In the kinds of contributions I made in the animal field were being made simultaneously at other places, so I can't say, you know, geez, I impacted the field this way. You know, I was part of what was going on. You know, I participated. You know, my work's cited for that, but I can't claim that had I not been there, that, you know, it would have been somehow a little different.
We're about to run. There's 35 minutes on there. If there are things you want to say on here, but after you finish, I want to tell you something about my perspective that I think will help you understand the simultaneity issue a little better.
Okay.
Okay.
So should I go through these?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So just very quickly. So this is the first. This is the Pickens study on chronic alcoholism. And so this is alcohol self-administration, bringing the methods of human behavioral pharmacology to that. And then I started marking things that fell off that, but then I gave up. I mean, so then there would be a system. There would be a number of publications that would have fallen out of that, you know, that would be threaded through this CV. This paper, I don't know if George mentioned this paper, but I think this is an important methodological paper for self-administration. And he was laying out this experimental models for modification of human self-administration exemplified by alcoholism. But I would say that actually captures in an important way, what it was we were bringing.
Okay, and this is paper number 10 on the CV.
On the CV, yeah. Then I'll come back to some of this. This would have been our first tobacco self-administration study, and this is one that I described yesterday, where we just happened to be looking at. We started looking at tobacco self-administration changed by alcohol, and so we started there, and then.
And is that the study you told me about where you just. You had noticed the cigarette. What was happening with the cigarette dispenser?
Yeah, we put the cigarettes there, and we watched cigarettes rate of cigarette smoking change as a function of alcohol self-administration. And it was very clean, very orderly, and set the occasion for us then to go systematically into cigarette smoking. I mean, it hadn't occurred to us. That too would be an interesting behavior. And so then that cigarette smoking then shows up here in the Henningfield, this 31, and this is a preparation for the experimental analysis of cigarette smoking behavior. So this is where now we're laying out a model for studying cigarette smoking behavior. And that study and this study also marked as cigarette smoking. I mean, if you pull those studies and looked at the figures, it's all individual subjects. It's like rats in boxes, and it's looking at the pattern of self-administration and then systematically manipulating dose over long periods of time. And, you know, so it speaks to everything we learned in the animal lab had generalized to alcoholics, and now systematically going into cigarette smoking.
And that speaks to two things, I think, that you said. One was your lament or your sense of loss of single subject, what you can get out of single subject design, and the other has to do with you spoke about a sort of minimalist approach. I.e., you should get what you can out of the least number of subjects. That was you, wasn't it?
No, I don't think.
Okay, that may have been someone else who had that kind of ethic. Oh, Ed Johnson talked about using the least number of subjects possible in order to get the sort of trying to optimize. These are all single subject or low number of subject experiments that you felt gave you, how would you name what?
Let's see. I mean, what does it do? These are intensive within subject designs that demonstrate the orderliness of the behavior under study. In this case, they're different forms of drug self-administration.
Right.
And I still, if I started studying ginseng self-administration, I would use those same methods. In spite of the fact that some people would want to see group data, if it were important to define it as a new phenomena, I'd still go back there, because group data doesn't tell you what the individual's doing. Mm-hmm. You can't, it just doesn't. So that represents the generality that then later comes in with caffeine. And so this is the, you know, this is our